Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
During her 30-year teaching career, Susan Chudy wrote books for teachers and young writers, two of them with her husband of 48 years, Stephen Chudy. Also with Stephen, Susan Chudy has hosted a program called Ecotopia on KZFR, and she's on the board of the Butte Environmental Council. She has a PhD in English composition and was an English professor at the University of Nevada. She is now retired and has written a book about family, memory, and the invisible fractures that shape our lives. The title of this novel is Fault Lines, The Geography of Love. Susan Chudy, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Great to be here.
Now, what inspired you to write this novel?
I knew that you were going to ask that question, and somehow I can't think of. I started it about 5 years ago, and I began. I had a character in mind. He was a psychologist, and he was a psychologist who had an interesting history in psychology himself. And so I began just writing episodes, and I began writing about him, and then his first wife, and his second wife, and then episodes with his children, and then I had a whole bunch of episodes, and I said, how do I make these episodes hang together? So,
well, how did you arrange this book?
Well, one interesting thing about this book is that there are five different narrators in the book. There are actually six. There's a third-person narrator, and that's Mark. And people ask me, why is that in third person? And it's because he is kind of the character around which everyone else revolves. And I wanted to set him off a little bit. The other characters are all in first person. There are five first-person narrations.
Well, I noticed that right away because I opened the prologue and I see he knew something was different. And so you don't know who he is. It takes a while for us to find out who he is. So, Susan, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit of your prologue for us.
Sure. It's called The Party. He knew something was different as soon as he turned onto his road. He could see a glow. As he drove the two blocks toward the house, the glow became brighter. The long driveway to his house was glowing, but no flashing lights, no police cruiser lights or ambulance lights or fire trucks. Then he saw a string of lights lining both sides of the driveway. The enormous trees surrounding the house were draped with lights. The house itself shone inside and out with more lights. He felt a wave of relief, but only momentarily. As he continued up the drive, he could see Hannah, the silver highlights of her hair gleaming. It almost looked like they were glowing from the inside. In recent years, she'd let it grow long again, and tonight the curls were barely contained, making a halo of light around her head and shimmering down her shoulders. She looked fine. Beautiful, really.
So, excuse me, Susan, but so we still don't know who he is, but we know her name, and her name is Hannah.
Right.
So, we still don't, if you'll continue, because we still don't know who he is.
That's right. He stopped, and she hopped into his car. What the hell? He said it lightly, controlling his anxiety with effort. I told you your 70th had to be spectacular. She leaned in and kissed him on the cheek. He turned to her, and the kiss was more lingering. Hannah, how on earth? Come on, she said, gently wiping lipstick off his lips. Your guests can't wait to see you. Guests? Who? Well, everyone. First, your family. But how? He didn't finish what was on his mind since he first saw the glittering trees. How did you manage this? Oh, it was all Isla and Sarah. Oh, and Andrew. And the grandkids were a big help, too. Mark and Hannah had been married for over 30 years and had come into this marriage with two teenagers each. Isla was his. Sarah was hers. Isla and Sarah. What were they thinking?
So there we find out who this he is that is in this story. And he and Hannah are having this conversation. We also learn the names of some more characters in your story. Okay, if you continue.
Hannah, how many people are here? Oh, gosh, I kind of lost count. You know, a lot of people don't RSVP anymore, so it's hard to keep track. And the girls took care of that. Ballpark? Maybe 80? Her voice went up to a question at the end. As he approached the garage door, Mark could see about a dozen people in front of the house, sitting on benches in the front garden. He was looking for Isla and Sarah. He could feel the tightness of his anger in his chest. Hannah chirped. He could tell she was happy. Most everyone's on the back decks. Richie is barbecuing chops and burgers. Oh, and veggie burgers. Richie was Hannah's oldest child, one who had gradually, over time, come back into the fold. Mark felt himself tense up. Hannah, he said it pleadingly, almost sadly. I know, but you know how it is. If you invite so-and-so, well, they know so-and-so, and you don't want them to feel left out. They pulled into the garage as she finished. And your whole family is here, including Marcus. He could hear the exuberance in her voice, saying that Mark's son, the drug addict, had actually made it. She came around the car to meet Mark and put her arms around his neck. He could feel some of his tension slipping away, and he pulled her to him, feeling her 70-year-old body still youthful through her silky, diaphanous dress. "Don't be upset. I know you'll have a lovely time. Everyone here loves you. Please don't be mad at me." Her breath was warm on his neck, and his enormous love for her welled up in him. "You're all right, then?" "Of course, I'm fine." Holding hands, they walked toward the guests. Then Hannah dropped his hand and exclaimed, "There's Dickie and she didn't finish identifying her two grandsons as they ran to hug her. But Mark thought morosely, "She still knows who they are, mostly."
This is my guest, Susan Chudy, and she's reading from a novel, Fault Lines, The Geography of Love. Geography of Love? That's not a geography is not a word you would expect in a novel about families. How did you name it that?
It's about the terrain, the whole terrain. So geography, fault lines, of course, is metaphorical. There are fault lines in the earth, but there are also fault lines in the terrain of our lives, of efforts to find and connect and have love and others in your life.
Well, we do know that one of the characters, Mark's son, is a drug addict, and that surely is a fault line, would you call it?
That is definitely a fault line.
In this geography that you just referred to.
Definitely a fault line.
Yeah, that makes us sad. Now, we feel happy, though, because look how sweet Mark and Hannah are to each other.
I was talking with someone who is going to represent the book for me at a bookstore, and she said, my readers come in and they say that they want something that has a happy ending. They don't like sad stories. And there is a lot of sadness in this story, but there is, and this I don't think is going to be a spoiler, there is the undying love, which ends. That there is the undying love of Mark and Hannah, and it's a wonderful love story.
Well, I thought of you and your husband because you two have been married for 48 years.
Yeah, there are some fault lines there.
Well, 48 years.
Long time.
Well, because of these family lines are so complicated, you give us a family tree.
I do.
And I tried even following it. Oh, golly, that's complicated.
I do. One of the things that people have told me, including Tom Hess, my yoga teacher, who's reading it, because there's a lot of yoga in this book as well. And I said, Tom, you know, I sort of channeled you for some of my dialogue in the book. And he said, the first few 50 pages or so were difficult because there are so many characters, and that he had to refer back to the family trees, and they follow the prologue before the rest of the narration begins. And some people haven't done that. They just figure it out, you know. I find whenever I start a new novel, I'm a little disoriented for a while. You know, what is this world? Who are these characters? How do they fit together? And I think because I have so many kind of significant characters and then lots and lots of secondary characters that, you have to get your feet on the ground figuring out who these people are at the beginning.
Feet on the ground, a family tree with feet on the ground, the roots. Okay.
We can carry these metaphors on.
That's true. That's so true. My guest is retired Professor Susan Chudy, and her book is Fault Lines, The Geography of Love. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Susan Chudy, whose book is Fault Lines, The Geography of Love. Okay, so in the prologue, we meet Mark, and the story's being told in the third person.
Correct.
Now, so that was the prologue. Book one, and you call this the family part one, starts out in the first person.
Right.
And who is this telling her story?
And this is Hannah's story. Hannah, we met in the prologue. She is his second wife, and he is her second husband. So this is a blended family. Sometimes they call it a reconstituted family. There are kind of lots of names for how people who marry and have children get designated. But Hannah, for me, is the moral center of the novel. She's also a gifted artist. She becomes internationally well-known in the course of the novel. She's lovely. I love her so much, Nancy. She's so wonderful.
She really is. And you give us the year, 2015, and you give her age. To me, that age sounds like young, particularly since the first sentence, when we read the first sentence, we thought, at age 70? Oh, Susan, would you read that section with Hannah talking?
5 years ago, I was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, a form of dementia. Dementia, demented. It conjures up images of the mad woman in the attic, of women pulling their hair out in crazed fury, of black prison cells where ragged, bedraggled people cling to the bars and cry and beg incoherently. Mark thinks I should be a stand-up comic and tell my dementia stories. He thinks I'm hysterical. I think he said hysterically funny, demented, and hysterical. I didn't resist when Mark talked with me about seeing a doctor concerning my increasing lapses. He calls them incidents. Incidents beyond just forgetting a name, like a day when I lost a couple of hours and didn't know what happened in that time. That had happened once in the beginning, and it really scared me. I was running to the grocery store to pick up a few things, a grocery store that I'd been to thousands of times, literally, and suddenly I didn't know where I was. I didn't know how to get to the store, and I didn't know how to get home. I asked Siri to call Mark, and he came for me right away. Luckily, I hadn't ventured from the route I always take. I've heard stories about people with Alzheimer's just wandering around while their families spent hours searching for them. I was actually relieved when he said that we'd go to the doctor. My internist sent me to a neurologist, and the tests began. They interviewed me. They interviewed Mark. They did memory tests, MRIs, CT scans, blood tests. They had to rule out various potential causes for my confusion. They even wanted to talk to the kids, Sarah and Rich. I expressed my frustration, I guess more than once, another symptom of my illness. I've become grumpy, ill-tempered. Sometimes Mark calls me cranky pants, trying to make light of it, but I feel like I'm becoming my disease. And yes, I do have Alzheimer's, but that's not the identity I want. That's not me. I'm someone else. And while I still have moments of lucidity, let me introduce the real me.
You know, this sounds so familiar. It makes me wonder, Susan, if you know somebody in this condition.
I have known, a couple of people, not people who are close to me, but people that I know, you know, kind of our friends and had dementia begin in their family. And I've watched the kind of heartbreak and struggle that brings and another kind of fracture, really, another kind of fault line where the person that you once knew is no longer that person. And you're having to negotiate a different kind of relationship, a fracture.
Well, I have a friend whose wife, this sounds like this could be her talking. I might mention, too, that there is an organization here. They're right next door to our radio station, and that is Passages. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar mm-hmm. with Passages?
I am familiar with Passages, yeah.
And they try to offer support and yes. help for people going through this.
Yeah.
So this section sounds almost too real, Susan.
That's good. I want it to feel real. I want people to suffer with both Mark and Hannah and the children even as they're watching, they're losing their mother or their stepmother. And she becomes very close to Mark's daughter. And so, you know, everybody suffers when a loved one begins to be someone else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I hear the sadness in my friend who's having to support his wife mm-hmm. going through this.
Yeah.
So you have all these various characters telling their, in the first person, mm-hmm. telling their story. Oh, what are some other examples? We have, we're told in the third person, we talk about Mark, and then Hannah is speaking in her words. And what other character do you think listeners might like to know about in your story?
All of them.
That's like asking you who's your favorite child.
Exactly,
yeah, okay.
Right. It's the four children. In addition to Hannah, it's the her two children, her older son, Richie, and then her daughter is Sarah. And Sarah and Isla are the same age during the whole time. They're the same age, but they first meet as teenagers. And then Mark's son, Marcus, the one who becomes a drug addict. And again, it's one of those things, I'm hoping those scenes, I have a friend who has a 50-something-year-old brother who's been a drug addict his whole life. And so, you know, I checked in with her about how the family has responded to that and coped with it. And it's another, you know, the family fractures and has fault lines again. So those are the four characters, plus Hannah. The four children are the four characters. Another character I really like, but she doesn't have her own narration. My daughter, when she read the novel, she said, I sort of like, her name is Maureen, and she's Mark's first wife. And they have a passionate relationship that doesn't finally work for very interesting reasons. But my daughter said, am I supposed to like her? Because I kind of do. And I said, I kind of like her too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm attached to all my characters one way or another. I mean, I really suffer with Marcus. You know, he just kind of is a, he's not a bad guy. He kind of fell through the cracks. And,
That seems real also.
Yeah.
In fact, your book, it must have taken you a long time to write this because it's not a short book.
It's a fat book.
Yeah, it's a fat book. Uh-huh. So how long did it take you to write this?
Probably from the time I started writing all of those episodes, it was probably about 5 years ago. And at the time, I was in a writing group. And so I had my writing group reading these episodes. And then finally I said, you know, I got to make something of this.
Yeah.
I have all this stuff.
Yeah.
And my husband supported me when I went away for several days to just trying to work it into some sort of coherent narrative. And I struggled with various ways of doing that. I ended up, after book one starts with the first book of the family, and that's 2015, where the book ends. And then we go back to the beginning of Mark's life in particular, and then it's chronological from there with characters interspersed as they're relevant to the story that is being told.
My guest is Susan Chudy, and her book is Fault Lines, The Geography of Love. And you read us a little bit of the prologue, so we get to see what that's like. I hesitated to ask you about the epilogue, though, because you don't want to tell people.
I don't.
No, I didn't think. I wouldn't want you to.
I mean, yeah, there are important things that happen that I'd rather not do that.
I agree with you. Yeah, I think people will want to see this story as it evolves and let them read your book to find out what's in the epilogue.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this book.
Great. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Again, my guest is Susan Chudy, and she's a retired English professor, and her book is Fault Lines, The Geography of Love. My next guest lives in Chester, California, a small town in Plumas County in the Sierra Nevada Mountains, not far from where he grew up, in Aden, California. George Wellman graduated from Chico State University in 1973 with a master's degree in business administration and spent his academic career at Chico State. He loves baseball and has played a coach for most of his life, most recently as an assistant coach for the Chester High School boys baseball team. Now that he has retired, George Wellman has written a book that he describes as creative fiction. He feels indebted to his cousin, childhood partner, and lifelong friend Spunk for the stories in this book, Spinner and Spunk, An American Story of Two Cousins Growing Up. George Wellman, welcome.
Well, thank you, Nancy, for having me today. It's nice to be in Chico, and you're having a nice, lovely day, so it's not too hot.
Well, I have a friend who is retired from Chico State University, and I said, did you know George Wellman? And he said, yes. Now, you may blush, but I want to tell you what he told me.
Oh, boy. Okay.
George Wellman was considered the best student by both his professors and fellow students in his class. It was no surprise that he took a position at the university when he completed his degree. He helped the university move into the computer age. He was never argumentative. He always listened carefully to what was being said and never heard him say anything negative about anyone or any position taken in a discussion with another. He respected the opinions of others, even if he disagreed with them. You could trust what he said. He was not prone to exaggeration, a solid guy you could count on for the unvarnished truth.
Now, who told you those lies, Nancy? Who was
no.
that? You're not going to tell me, are you?
Well, this person was very complimentary, and I particularly like the fact that he said you never heard him say anything negative or against their position. You said he listened to what was being said, even if you didn't agree with that person. I thought, boy, do we need to hear that today more than ever, I think.
Well, I agree. I agree. Yeah. But that I would honestly say that was a quality attribute that a number of people over the years had commented to me about that. So
and appreciated, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Also, you count on him for the unvarnished truth. So as I read that, because I wrote down what he said, and I thought that maybe is why George calls his book, instead of a memoir or calling it fact, you're calling it creative fiction. And I think that's why, because you thought, well, I can't remember exactly. So even though you've got photographs of you and your cousin and all this seems so real, but so why did you call it?
Well, in fact, it is the genre of creative nonfiction. It's real events of my cousin and I over a 2-year period, 2 summers. And the reason it is creative nonfiction is because
Well, you know what? Excuse me for interrupting, but let me ask you to read from your book what you say about creative nonfiction. Would you read that? That's toward the end of your book. What do you say is creative nonfiction?
Yeah, yes, perfect, Nancy. I'll read this. Creative nonfiction writing is defined as the craft of accurately telling true stories that are personally reflective and immersive, well-researched, and based on real-life experiences. This form of writing emphasizes personal reflection, spanning genres such as memoirs, personal essays, and engaging narrative. I believe I adhered to and honored the principles of this genre. As the author and key character in this story, I felt an overwhelming need to fully capture the essence of the characters in the storyline as they are real people with real identities. A lot of the research required me to contact family and friends to confirm facts, especially regarding nicknames. I could have used everyone's real names, but I didn't because I wanted to create a creative story, give it a personal, emotional feel, and not just write a historical documentary. The reason for writing the book was to document what two cousins experienced at a young age and to preserve this story for my family and friends. Preserving the story is what drove me to write. I had to make sure the story of Spinner and Spunk was not lost or forgotten.
Excuse me for interrupting, George, but notice you say that to preserve this story for my family and friends. And I think that's a gift, a real gift, that you preserve this story for your family. If nobody else ever reads it but family, it would be worthwhile, I think.
Precisely, and I agree with you totally, Nancy. If I only publish, say, 10 copies of this just for family members, closest family,
yeah,
that's enough reward for me that it's now preserved in this bit of literature about the story of Spinner and Spunk. So,
and they might not, at the time you give it to them or time they read it, might not appreciate it as much as when they get older and will be so grateful to you. What I think.
I agree. No, I totally agree.
Would you continue?
The reason for writing a book was to document
the story of Spinner and Spunk was not lost or forgotten.
Okay, yes. It took over a year to complete the rough draft, followed by several months of editing, rewrites, and revisions. As I learned from watching a couple of master classes, writing is a challenge that requires focus, imagination, hard work, and unwavering dedication. There were times I nearly quit, times I couldn't compose a single word, times that left me feeling exhausted. Then there were other times when the words and sentences came easily and energized me. This being my first book, I can honestly say the experience has been totally worth it. My recommendation to anyone who has thought about writing, it would be to just start.
This is my guest, George Wellman. He's reading from his creative nonfiction, Spinner and Spunk, an American story of two cousins growing up. So let's go to the very beginning, the first chapter of your book, where we meet this cousin of yours and meet some of your family. And this is in Aden. And some people, Californians, Aden? What? Where?
Not many people know where it is, Nancy. So, but that's fine with, you know,
well,
we kind of like it that way, actually.
Why don't you tell us who these people are that you're, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit from this first chapter. And you mentioned your Uncle Max, for example, and he made his usual grand entrance. Now, where is he entering? Where are you? Are you in the kitchen at your house?
He's entering off the back porch into the kitchen. You want me to read that piece?
Yeah, okay. If you would.
This was one of my favorite couple of paragraphs, and it's in the very first chapter.
Yes.
Uncle Max made his usual grand entrance, saving the two of us from further scrutiny. "What's for breakfast?" Uncle Max bellowed as he sauntered through the back porch into the kitchen. To say Uncle Max sauntered is more than a slight understatement. Max was a big man, 6 feet and 210 pounds, with bright blue eyes, short-cropped black hair, and a warm smile. His considerable posture made him stand out. More realistically, Uncle Max's entry would best be described as a bull rush, fully announcing his presence. Since it was into Mom's kitchen sanctuary, Max was certainly courting severe retribution.
Excuse me, now we meet, it was Mom's kitchen, so we'll probably meet Mom, and she's quite a character. Oh, I got a kick out of her. Okay, if you continue, because you're saying the two of us, you're referring to Spunk, your cousin,
correct.
Spunk, and yourself.
Okay. Correct.
So what did you do?
Let me continue here, Nancy. "Sit down, Max. Your eggs will be ready in a minute. Coffee's in the pot, cups in the cupboard. Get your own." Spunk and I quietly tiptoed from the front room into our bedroom and cautiously approached Uncle Max. "Aha, there you boys are. Come on over here and let's take a look." "Holy road apples, Aunt Dodie. These boys are nearly all grown up. Did you boys get some of Aunt Dodie's tasty home cooking this morning?" Uncle Max asked, sensing the tension. "Yes," we both mumbled in a low tone, fully expecting Mom's skillet attack to be on the horizon. Mom seemed to subside a little at that point as she handed Uncle Max a plate of eggs and two burned pancakes. Uncle Max graciously thanked Dottie, consuming the whole plate and two cups of coffee in short order. Uncle Max's gut was full of eggs, coffee, and charcoal pancakes. Mom got her revenge and satisfaction in that subtle, passive-aggressive sort of way. "Breakfast is over," Mom announced, loud and clear. Dad and Uncle Max took the clue and exited the kitchen, Spunk and I in hot pursuit.
My guest is local author George Wellman, and his book is An American Story of Two Cousins Growing Up. We're going to take a short break and continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, George Wellman, and reading from his book, Spinner and Spunk, An American Story of Two Cousins Growing Up. Now, the name Spunk comes up in your reading because that was your cousin's name. Oh, that's what you're calling him in this book.
Correct.
But you haven't mentioned the word Spinner. And that was you.
Yeah, spinner is me, and I don't divulge it very early on, and probably not until the part of the book which talks about me. I have a section about the author. Some people might read this and wonder, well, who are these, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Some of my closest family figured it out quickly, but other readers are going, are you one of those people? And I said, well, finish the book and then we'll talk. So I kind of liked a little bit of mystery about it. So,
well, I did mention when I introduced you that you love baseball. And you have played baseball. You've been a coach for most of your life. And so you have a scene later on. This is later on in your book. If we're going to skip over now to chapter 19. And tell us about your, not a career, but with baseball. And what did you like about baseball?
It goes clear back to the time I was probably 8 years old. I had an older brother, and he was an athlete, baseball in particular. So growing up with him around, and then moving into my Little League age days, which are described in this very chapter, I was 11, and that just carried on my whole life because I had a wonderful time playing Little League, played high school baseball, played one year at a community college, and just I've always been a fan. It's as simple as that.
Well, baseball was a really big deal back in the day when I was growing up. In fact, my dad, between undergraduate and graduate school, played semi-pro baseball. And the whole time I knew him, he couldn't raise his right arm above his shoulder because he'd been a pitcher. And, oh, my dad loved baseball. So I can understand your enthusiasm for this sport. And you also mentioned Uncle Max was a big guy. And your cousin that you call Spunk, oh, man, look at the photographs, and he was a big guy.
Quite a large Spunk. I'll just describe him physically.
Yeah.
6 feet, 6'1", maybe, in his tremendous athletic days, 235.
Yeah, and he's your cousin, so he's a blood relative, and yet he was baseball. He could play more than baseball. He could play football.
His greatest sport, what he enjoyed more than anything else, was shot put.
Yeah,
track and field sports, but he also threw the hammer. But he also played football. He's in the Shasta College Hall of Fame. For both sports, football and his shot put career. So
this is your dear cousin that you grew up with, and the two of you have been were lifelong friends.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. And I would just mention it now. I didn't think I was going to do it this morning, Nancy, but I just need to mention it. Spunk left me on December 2nd, 2018, unfortunately, from a long illness. And I've always thought, why didn't I get this written before then?
Well, in fact, I even wondered whether to ask you to say that he had passed away. But well, let's go back to the baseball field.
Okay.
So this was in chapter 19, and are you a player? Because you are a coach, but many years later, after you were an adult.
Yeah, this is when I was still a Little League player.
Yeah.
This chapter.
A little League player,
yeah,
when you were young.
11 years old.
11 years old,
yeah.
And you're out there on the baseball field. And so you give us a list of the members of this team. Of course, you didn't use the real names. So in this little photograph you have of the game of your team playing a rival. And the second person listed is Spinner, and of course that's you.
That'd be me. Yep.
And who's playing this game? Who are you playing? Is your team playing?
We're playing a team from a bigger town. We're in Aiden's a very small town. Even back then, it had a population of 500 or less. So we were kind of the small town in Modoc County. All the other teams we played were primarily from the town of Valturas, which had I don't know, 3,000 residents or something. So they
So here you are, this little bitty team from this little bitty town, well, regular team, playing this much larger, they could draw a lot more people, yeah. kids to draw from
yeah.
to make up their team.
Exactly.
And here you are playing, and what's their team called?
2030 Club, which was a service club in Alturas. So the 2030 Club sponsored that team, and this is one of my favorite chapters, Nancy.
I can see why. Well, even your descriptions, I loved, because my dad played a hometown team, and your description of the baseball field sounded, well, that sounds like where my dad played when I was growing up. So what was that field like? Green grass?
Well, it's almost, thinking back, it's hard to even realize we played on a field like that. It was all dirt, no grass. There was no outfield fence. At a few hundred feet beyond first and second base, you would run into sagebrush. There'd be jackrabbits. There'd be quail.
Well,
truly a sandlot yeah. baseball field.
Yeah. Well, there wasn't any sage and jackrabbits where my dad was playing, but I'm just thinking I'm reading your story, thinking, oh, that brings back memories. I have to stop and think, oh, my gosh, this sounds familiar. So I think people who read your book will go back, if they lived through those times, will bring back memories and inspire them to write, or maybe ask Granddad, did you play on a sandlot when you were growing up?
Yeah, yeah. And I hope that does happen because my experience is an experience a number of people my age, certainly back in those times, would know exactly what I'm describing there. And I just got a comment a half hour ago before I showed up here, Nancy, from somebody that started reading the book, and they skipped to this chapter. I told them, don't skip chapter, but they did. And he had to share with me, this fellow, I had the same experience in Little League.
The title of this chapter, by the way, is Cracking Balls and Scoring Runs. And so you've set up who the opponents are, who Raz was. And I got a kick out of that. Who was Raz? He wasn't on the team. Who was he?
No, he was the umpire. He was one of the elders, the adults, always involved with us in Little League and other things in our little old town. He was an educated man. He was we would call him the head controller. He was called, I think, the company accountant in the lumber mill back in those days. But he was just one of those iconic fellows.
And you say he was 6'3".
He was
and long arms.
Yeah. Tall, spindly. Everybody knew Raz. I don't know how else to say it.
So
he was a character.
Yeah. This well-respected member of the community
yes.
is your umpire.
Yes.
And anything else that we should know before? Well, how are you doing so far? Before I ask you to read a little bit of this, how's your team doing against your rivals?
Coming into the game that's described in that chapter, our record was 17-1.
Okay.
One loss.
Okay.
And it was to that team.
The same team that you played.
That they're now on our field playing us the last game of the season.
So why don't you start reading where you started to take the field?
We started to take the field when Catfish Sam rushed up to the dugout, pointing to Hammer and me. We paused, waiting for him to say something. The spirit of Kamush is with you. He will guide you. He will keep you strong, Sam said in a way that left both of us inspired and exhilarated. Hammer and I stood for a few seconds, not saying a word, tapped our gloves, tipped our caps to Sam, and sprinted to our positions. As I took the mound, I pumped my fist to Lucky as he headed to center field. He returned the gesture. I felt a tingle down my spine. I thought to myself, 2030 Club, you're in for a whooping.
This is my guest, George Wellman. He's reading from his book, Spinner and Spunk, an American story of two cousins growing up. And I love the sweet cover with you and these two young boys and their bicycles. And I just imagine, oh, there they are. There's Spinner and Spunk. Now, you mentioned that this dear lifelong friend of yours is no longer with us. And I would like you to read a little bit of the epilogue in your book, George.
Yes, Nancy, yeah. Let me start right at the beginning. The Spinner and Spunk summer adventures tapered off as we grew older. The summer of 1959 and 1960 were the most memorable. We held these memories in our hearts throughout adulthood. To this day, I can recall those fun days as vividly as if they were yesterday. In 1968, Spunk joined the Navy, serving during the Vietnam War as an electronics technician. He went on to be a champion field athlete in high school and college and was inducted in to the Shasta College Sports Hall of Fame in the late 1990s as a shot putter. The University of Nevada, Reno, then recruited him. Spunk lived nearly his entire adult life in Whitmore, California, in the wooded foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. He had one son, John, who was a gifted shot putter. John was also inducted into the Shasta College Sports Hall of Fame and later became an All-American at Chico State.
Now, I'm going to ask you to skip to where you say that you and your cousin, Spunk, you're calling him, stayed in touch with each other. You continued to hunt and fish together, and he became a master salmon fisherman on the Sacramento River, and he loved that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, he had such a wonderful knack for catching fish. I don't know how else to say it.
Well, I'm going to ask you to, if you will skip to, you say Spunk left us on December, if you would skip to that part, because I'd like for you to read that very last part of your epilogue.
Spunk left us on December 2nd, 2018, after a long illness. He was 68 when he passed. The humor and grounded sense of reality I learned from Spunk during those earliest days together carried me emotionally and spiritually for all these years. I wrote this memorial poem sitting on the banks of the Sacramento River the day we celebrated his life. Saying goodbye to Spunk. I sat by the river alone, but not lonely. I felt you there. You gently patted me on the head. You said, "My work is not done, nor is yours, Spinner. I'll see you down the way." I said, "Goodbye, Spunk. I'll never forget you."
This is the cousin of Spunk. His name is George Wellman, and the book that he has written, Spinner and Spunk, an American story of two cousins growing up. Thank you so much for writing this book, George.
Wow. It's one of the most, probably one of the most important things I've done in my whole life, Nancy, to preserve this story of the two of us.
Thank you from all of us.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. I hope everybody enjoys it.
And I would also like to thank my first guest, retired Professor Susan Chudy, whose book is Fault Lines, The Geography of Love. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Memento vivere. We were sweating over hot grills heaped with a greasy mesquite that sparked a parody of Bosch at a fundraiser or some festival lost in the fading whenever that was. From the smoke, she manifested with a cold beer gripped in each hand, a portable respite from spluttering meat and oysters bubbling in butter. We melted right into those bottles. I said, from that joyous emotion of propinquity and major gratitude, "I think I'm in love with your wife." Myself effervescent in the moment, like some schoolboy taking first prize. Your mouth twitched toward a grin, and you leaned down close to my ear. while I considered the need to fly. You said, with just a minor inflection, "As it turns out, so am I." Philip Hemingway.
March. Sun and heat surprised us from long gray months of dreamless torpor. We squeezed into shorts, jogged along the river. Bones creaked, muscles loosened. Poppies stretched golden orange palms to the sun. Fresh greens burst from stark and naked oaks. Color dripped from every stem and branch, white blossoms, lavenders, and blues. Even from weeds, tiny purples hung like bells. Just as we found our stride, caught up to the riot of spring, and began to dance with it, clouds gathered over the western hills. Poppies closed their petals. Clouds thickened and tumbled over us, driven by March winds. Blossoms trembled from trees. Miles from the end of the trail, we shivered in this sudden winter. We folded ourselves into our homes, always asynchronous in the odd California rhythm of drowsy lethargy and sudden change. Here March is the cruelest month, fickle, reminding us of the dream of California, as inconsequential and riveting as a single lavender blossom quavering in the wind. Michelle Small.
This one's called Bones. My bones are like a grinding spot. Each is mortar and pestle to the other, making themselves into bone meal. Mix some into your morning coffee, or sprinkle me into your soups and stews for good luck. Include me in your potion making, your life-giving elixir, your magic making. Let my strength become yours. I relinquish it to you, and you relinquish ours unto the next. Emma Miller.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.